Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Phoenix Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to Phoenix Business Radio, broadcasting live from Business Radio X studio in downtown Tempe, where we will build businesses and connect you with the right people. I'm Karen Nowicki, and I am very honored and excited today to meet a few women who I've never been blessed with the presence of being with. Dr. Christine Quaid, founder of Athena Valley of the Sun. Welcome, Christine.
Thank you.
And Dr. Eileen Boris, international igniter of change, clinical and political psychologist. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I told both of you before we went on air that I'm a little embarrassed that I don't know anything. I mean, I know a little bit now that I've read your bios and knew that we have an event coming up. But about Athena Valley of the Sun, can we start with that and have you just get us caught up? How long has it been around and who is Athena Valley of the Sun serving?
All right. Well, start from the top. How's that? So International Athena was founded 35 years ago by Martha Mertz. She was in Lansing, Michigan on the Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors, the first woman, and discovered in a nomination process when she wanted to nominate other women for the board that she was told, it's okay, sweetheart. We really don't want women on the board because they're not really leaders. And so she thought, I think I have a little bit of work to do. This is 35 years ago. Which is why I really love her, because it's paralleling my own corporate journey and my own other journeys. So she decided the way to help the women in business in that community was to create an award. So she created the Athena Award, which kind of went across countries based on through the Chambers of Commerce. And then in the mid-90s, there was a Kellogg Research Foundation grant awarded, and the Center for Creative Leadership did the study and interviewing over 400 women to come up with the 8 Athena Leadership Principles. And so she goes, ha-ha, now that's my work. And so when I met Martha about 4 years ago, I said, okay, now what's going on in your world? And she says, everyone's really excited about the awards because it's an honoring. It's, you know, it's an honoring of somebody who's excelled in business, but nobody's talking about the principles. And I said, oh, do you want to be my pal with that one? And so that's how we got the Athena Valley of the Sun started. So we focus solely on the principles.
And are the awards based on the principles then, or how does that kind of come together?
So the other awards are generally, you know, for one woman who's been successful in business. What we decided to do is chunk it down and say, we're looking for women who are igniting change in their community. And with 6 of the principles using give back and celebrate as the themes Brilliant. For our event. So,
wow. And tell us about your background. How did you, other than this, hey, let's be pals and let's do this together.
Yeah. I'm a big collaborator. So, started off as a lawyer in California in the late 70s, when it turns out that I was misdirected in my ambition because I really thought that it was a great opportunity for women to be in the courtroom. And in my second month of trial practice, I watched the judge excuse a female attorney from the courtroom because she had on a pantsuit. And I went, I'm in so much trouble here.
And this is 2 months in?
Yes.
After all that time and money
I was
spent
sure I was
education.
The new Perry Mason. I was sure I was the new Perry Mason. I was just positive. So I kept my practice going for about 18 months. I had 180 clients and experienced a lot of, you know, rigor from the male judges from the bench in rulings and motions and et cetera. So it's just like, no, this is not going to work. So I went to work for McDonnell Douglas. And had a great 11-year career there, causing all kinds of trouble.
Yeah. I love it.
So I think it kind of fed my little troublemaker thing.
The original igniter of change.
Yes. Then went and got my master's in organization change. Oh, darn. Gave me a good foundation. And left McDonnell Douglas, moved to Minnesota to be a good external consultant for 20 years. And then moved here, where I discovered that either the women's movement skipped Arizona or the glass ceiling was sinking again. And I could legitimately go dust off all the material I had for McDonnell Douglas and it would still be relevant. And it broke my heart.
Especially because we're such a relatively new state and we're booming, right? We're in the mecca of IT. We're more and more businesses and families, even entrepreneurs, are moving here to get started. So I'm frustrated to hear that.
Yes. And so when I came across the Athena Leadership Principles, I said, oh, this is the way to ignite change.
Absolutely.
Thank you for asking.
Oh, my goodness. Welcome. All right. So how did the two of you connect?
Oh, that's a good story.
Is it one for on air?
Yes.
Well, I was late in October, just kind of going through all those emails and trying to delete what I thought was spam. And I came across a very interesting one from a wonderful lady named Chantel. And she began by telling her story of how she found my name through the internet because of my work in forgiveness and speaking at the United Nations. And then she proceeds to tell me about something called the Athena Award and would I accept being the recipient of the Leadership Award.
Wow.
And I just about, I couldn't believe it. So I emailed back. I said, this is such an incredible honor. Of course, I would love to be a recipient. She calls within a nanosecond.
Of course she does.
And she starts telling me about everyone. Of course, Christine was the first name that came up. And we then got connected very quickly, met soon after. And I have been enjoying Christine ever since. There's just so many parallels. You worked, Christine, you know, more in the corporate ladder. Mm-hmm. I worked more on an international track. But everything
collides, doesn't it?
Together.
It
does. It's just incredible. So I feel so humbled and honored to be the recipient. And in the process, I have met such wonderful Athena women, thanks to Christine.
And these are not just Arizona women. This is across our country, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is it an international group as well, or is it really?
No, it's an international group. We have affiliates in China, Mexico, UK, et cetera.
What an honor.
Definitely. And what really excites me more than anything else is that for me, yes, personally, it's a nice honor, but the work I do in forgiveness and in leadership is so important. And I loved your story about, you know, coming here and finding what happened to this glass ceiling here. You know, I'm from the East Coast, so I'm dealing with a different kind of culture. And then when I came back here, it was like, you know, we do speak the same language and we use the same currency, but where did I land? Kind of thing. So to be able to have a platform to talk about leadership and change and how the leaders that I've been working with have had to change their mindset and how this parallels to the work of forgiveness. And most importantly for me at this point is also political forgiveness, which I'm writing a book on. Most people don't understand it, but it requires something very special from leaders. So having this wonderful honor is giving exposure to the power of forgiveness and the power of political forgiveness and the role leaders play in all of that. And that's what's really important to me.
Right. It's a platform for that opportunity to teach, to lead, and to strengthen mm-hmm. where we need to go. Well, congratulations.
And Christine is keeping me very busy with that.
I have no doubts. And again, just this beautiful mesh and this tapestry that's been woven with this friendship as well as the awards and Athena. It's absolutely incredible. So how do these global issues impact women here locally? We talked a little bit about landing here in Arizona. How are we impacted by some of these global issues?
You know, it's really interesting. I was thinking about this and I was thinking about what are the issues for women? And then I thought, I'd be curious to see what are the issues for women in areas of conflict? And believe it or not, they parallel each other.
Yep.
Even in conflict, you would think that maybe the first issue, the most important one, would be violence. But in fact, it's employment. So across the board, one of those major global issues is that women get paid less, women have jobs that are maybe mediocre, they're not the high-ranking jobs. Even in government, we have, you know, women make up 51% of the population. They have 7% of heads of state type jobs. And so what that does, when you have a workforce that is lacking in women, productivity is down at least 25%. So this is how these global issues impact what's going on locally. And we need to widen this workforce for us to all do better. And then, you know, you kind of go down the line, and the second issue is education. You know, one in four in developing countries get beyond primary school.
One in four.
Yeah. And so this is a really big issue. If they're not educated, how can women go to work? And then you've got all these other issues that go on about violence. You've got children getting married before 18. And when they get married before 18, they're much more prone to intimate partner violence, not getting educated for sure. Mm-hmm. And so you've got this vicious cycle of women who are put in these really humiliating situations, who can't get educated, who can't get good jobs, who cannot have political voice. And if women don't get into these political positions, you've got men following their own agendas. And so the agendas of women get sidelined, or not even discussed, or not even thought about.
A tag on to that, thank you for bringing that up, is that in China, if you are choose to further your education and not get married right out of school, you are considered a leftover woman, which is like leftover food on a plate scraped into the garbage can. So the women who choose to go for master's instead of getting married, they don't see that they have a choice, that they can do both. Because it's go to get married, move in with my husband's family's village, mm-hmm. or do I go to school and become educated? And so, you know, there's a whole body of women that are choosing to go for education right. and are living that leftover right. women label.
It's interesting because culturally, in many different countries, things happen that really, really hurt women. You know, I think about in Japan, for example, their philosophy was following Confucianism. And so males dominated. Mm-hmm. And so you've got the same kind of thing that happens. There's male superiority over the female. So the female doesn't get the jobs again. There's domestic abuse as a result of this sense of superiority. There's emotional abuse that happens. There's sexual exploitation. You know, we don't think about all the things that happen when you've got a male superiority type situation, what happens to women? And this is across the board, even in the United States.
That's what I was going to ask you. So the question I asked was, how does what's going on globally impact us here locally, or how is it? And you've said it's similar. There's a parallel. So when I look to these other countries, impoverished countries, I'm aware of the devastation and how women have been kept down. And then we always think that in the U.S. that we have it better. But the truth is, right, you're both shaking your heads. No, we don't. So let me ask this by saying, I think I understand what you're saying. As we raise our vibration for women here in Arizona and across the U.S., and we help educate and create leadership opportunities and equal the pay scale and all the things that we need to do here on our ground, then in masses, we can continue to, because I know there's a lot of people doing great work mm-hmm. in other countries from the U.S., in fact. But then we can continue to be a force for good outside of our own borders.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that actually, Christine, when you were talking about your work and getting mm-hmm. out those dusty handbooks, it's about raising consciousness. Mm-hmm. And I think what disturbed me, and I suspect disturbed you, is that we're both similar age. We're both women libbers, right?
Yes. I'll fess up to it.
We worked hard for women's rights. You know, I was in New York, which was just a hotbed of all this activity and trying to raise the consciousness of women. And then you come here and it's different. So if your work is to help raise consciousness and to start empowering women, which is so wonderful about what Athena is doing, that becomes critical, because we have to work on psyches of both men and women. In men, the psyche, it's so ingrained that they are much stronger. They can do things that women can't do. And we're trying to break that type of thinking, which is so embedded. But then there are women who have psyches which want to be taken care of and, you know, which play into that male psyche. And what they don't understand is that that disempowers women. Mm-hmm. So if women can really begin to own who they are, own their skills, own their power. And I'm not talking about power over someone.
Right.
I'm talking about being empowered so they can really get in touch with what is my life's purpose? What is it that I want to give to this world and know that they can give it? That's really powerful. And then when you get people like Malala, for example, who under all, you know, reasons should be not doing what she's doing. Mm-hmm. And at age 10 or 11, she's writing a diary about what is it like to live under all this oppression and recognizing the importance for education. And of course, we know what happened when she got shot and her whole recovery. And what's interesting about that, she was able to change her mindset and recognize the power of women and the importance of empowering women, and became an incredible leader. And interestingly enough, I think for leaders to be really great, they have to transform their thinking, which is also what happens in forgiveness.
I'm right there with you. This is all around it's education, but it's the mindset shift, mm-hmm. and being willing to step into forgiveness. Amazing. Now, in my world, forgiveness has come from forgiving family members or asking for forgiveness. It relates to a situation at work. Until I had a chance to get introduced to you in preparation for today, I didn't realize how that you were even out there making this incredible impact on our nation. And other nations around forgiveness when it comes to political forgiveness, corporate forgiveness. So can you help our listeners and myself included bridge that gap between what it's like to forgive and how important that I get why it's important for me from my home, mm-hmm. and my family and, you know, my neighbors or whatever it is. And trust me, I'm working on a couple of those things right now because I do understand the value of it. How does that play out when we're talking about organizations and corporations and nations, for goodness sakes?
I want to share a story. I like stories. And this is a story about the chief negotiator in South Africa before apartheid was dissembled. His name is Ralph Meyer. And he was privileged white in South Africa, went to the best schools, became a lawyer, really benefited from the system that he was living under. And one day, he heard the story, or he was relating the story of a white farmer was in his pickup truck, and in the cab of his, in the back of the truck, was a South African black boy and his dog. And it began to pour. And so the farmer stopped the car, went to the back, got the dog, left the child in the pouring rain. It was humiliating. And Ralph saw this. And intellectually, he began to understand that things have got to change. That here he's this representative of all these people, because he was part of the government at that time, but he was only representing a tiny piece. Mm-hmm. Now, we're beginning to parallel forgiveness here. What happened over the years is that he began to work for the government. Botha said to him, you need to go into these townships and find out why in the black townships there's so much rioting. He went there, and through all of these experiences, it took him 12 years to get from that intellectual level to the emotional level of what's going on. Now, the parallel here is when we personally try to forgive, it takes us a while to get from that intellectual, I kind of understand where they're coming from, to the emotional level of, God, if I walked into that person's shoes, this is what I'd really experience, and it would be just as easy for me to behave that way. It was through that realization that Meyer decided that in order for there to really be peace in South Africa, they have to think, what do they want South Africa to look like? Mm. Which meant constitutional change. And here again, the parallel is when something happens to us, we get really angry. We want to do something. We want revenge. And I even say to people who I work with when I see my private clients, write out your revenge story. Have fun with it.
And when you have to spend some time in that space.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And then ask yourself, does this get me what I really want? And so in politics, that's the question that comes back now. Is this going to get us what we really want for our country? And so he had a total shift in his thinking. He was able to transform himself and finally let go of that mental thinking of white superiority. These are the deep things in our psyches. And as a result of his inner work, which is what forgiveness requires, he was able to start supporting outer change. And he was one of the people responsible for freeing Nelson Mandela. And he was one of the chief architects for dismantling apartheid.
Oh my gosh.
And it was all because he learned that power of the importance of changing mindsets and being able to forgive. So that's kind of one piece of how is this connected between leadership and forgiveness. And, you know, we can talk more about it. And political forgiveness, which is different than individual forgiveness, works on the individual level, works on the community level. How do we bring communities back together? And works on structural change, which is what you could see Rolf Meyer do. He changed the structures that supported the violence to structures that could finally support peace and justice. I hope that answered.
It's a beautiful.
Your question.
It answers it perfectly.
I'll carry it a bit further. So it's what's occurring to me is that it's about dismantling our epistemology. Mm-hmm. So our epistemology is, you know, where we grew up, who influenced us during our first 6 years, our parents' beliefs, the church's beliefs, the school's beliefs, our teacher's beliefs, et cetera, that we carried all the way through for us as we went out into the world. And so our belief system could be based on something that is totally erroneous. And yet we go blindly forward, which is why I love the principle of live authentically, mm-hmm. which is about really revisiting our identity. What is our identity and how do we formulate our perception of how we fit in with the world and not only who we are, but who do we want to be? And how do we see ourselves being influenced again? Are we able to be resilient enough to open our minds, open our hearts, open our blind spots to mm-hmm. see that, oh, there's a whole different world out there. And the only way I can see it is by being around people who are different from me.
Yes. Absolutely.
Different from me. If we see it if we see ourselves in others and we're just totally attached to them, we're just seeing the part of ourselves that we like. But when we encounter that part that John really liked that person, it's like, oh, what a great opportunity for me to discover what is one of my blind spots.
Right. And yet so many of us are conditioned to look to that other person and go, oh, we're different, or I don't like you, and find a way to shut that relationship down, whether it's a business relationship or a personal relationship or a neighborly one, shut it down so that we can stay in our little blindfold. Mm-hmm. And yet we're really talking about helping people show up in those relationships different. Don't go into them needing to get stepped on or planning to get stepped on, but how can you navigate, right? And I'm really looking to you, ladies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How can I navigate this relationship that feels crunchy, feels sticky and hard, so that I can come out the other end of it having learned something and not only about myself, but about others?
Mm-hmm. And that what you're asking about is really describing the forgiveness process. Even if we don't recognize it, you know, I might be meeting you for the first time and you might be ethnically very different than me. But if something gets triggered in me, it's really not about you. It's about something inside of me that I need to look at and I need to challenge, because that's where my healing takes place. So if I recognize right off, okay, these are my issues, not has nothing to do with you, it begins to at least open the door for me to be receptive to you. And if I can really say, okay, it triggered fear because of the unknown or whatever the issues are, I can begin to deal with that. And ideally, and this is really a characteristic of a good leader, I should have the ability to open my heart and say to myself, what would my life look like if I walked into your shoes? And to really try to understand the psychological landscape from which you are coming from. And what's interesting about this for me, because I work with groups in conflict all the time, and, you know, enemies coming together, and you can see viscerally how they're feeling. But if I can get them to a point where they can begin to walk in that other person's shoes, they're going to recognize that if they had that other person's life, they probably wouldn't act much differently. I have a dear friend named Jo Barry. She is British. Her father was part of a member of parliament. And in 1984, they were having a conference and her father went to a pub like everyone does and a bomb went off. It was the Brighton bombing. And he was killed. The person that was responsible for his death was put in prison and was there until the Good Friday Accords. Meanwhile, Jo was seething. I mean, she was close to her father. She lost her father, all that anger and all of that. And she finally got to a point when she said, I don't want this anger to cloud my memory of my father. And so she decided to reach out to Pat McGee, who was the person that was responsible for her father's death. And they met. And they struggled because they both, you know, at one point would be very angry with each other. One point couldn't understand each other. He couldn't understand where she was coming from. She couldn't understand why he was so passionate about what he was doing, that he would kill people for it. Mm-hmm. But eventually, as they got to know one another and began to understand one another, they actually began to work with one another to share their message. And she did realize, as well as he, that if they switched lives, they wouldn't be acting any differently than each other at this point. And it's a powerful message. And they both now go around the world now sharing the struggles of what it takes to do that real inner work, but the understanding that comes from it, and that this is just so important that in this world today, groups in conflict need to come together and need to go through processes where they can really begin to understand the other without blame, without judgment. Because we're one human family. We're all acting. We're more alike than different. And we need to remember that if we were put in someone else's situation, we probably would not have acted much differently.
You can see why she's going to be our recipient.
Oh my goodness. Absolutely. Wow. So many questions and so many thoughts. One popping in, and this really isn't where I thought I would go. I feel that we are blessed and cursed somewhat with this whole thing of social media. Mm-hmm. The story that you've just shared is I'm not sure that I've heard that story before, but I've seen others similarly. And it motivates me and inspires me for change when the story is there and available. And yet there are other aspects of social media where I feel like we're being more oppressed and we're not looking for commonalities and similarities. We're standing in our power, male and female, saying, you know, this is how it should go. Any thoughts around that? I mean, that could be a whole
session right there.
It is, but I couldn't help but think of it because as you beautifully shared both those stories.
We've become a very polarized society and it's a position of righteousness now. So every side is just trying to convince the other side that they're wrong and that if they could just come over to my side. And there's some work done by Barry Johnson on polarity management, which is understanding that when we take the high road, what we're really doing is declaring that we're fearing the other side's low road. Mm. So it becomes like a map, you know, a hierarchical map that, you know, we cross over from up to down. The upside of my side fears the downside of your side. So that's all I'm arguing against is the fear of what might happen if your side actually came forward as more truthful than mine. So we've just like pulled ourselves. I don't think I've ever seen this country in this kind of polarization. We are not listening to each other. And I'm right in there as well. I mean, I walk by a TV and I see some people on TV and I turn my face and I don't even want to see the faces anymore. And I go, well, that's not really helping me heal what I need to heal. And I go, well, maybe another lifetime. And then I'll hang around Dr. Boris and she'll help me figure it out.
But we are being called to feel that.
Right.
That's how I look at these situations when even just within, again, my little network and I see it happening on Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn, I'm like, dear goodness, what is going on? But I'm faced to have to feel that as you expressed.
Mm-hmm. And I think we all have this visceral reaction. So you're in good company.
Okay. Thank you.
And I have clients that come in for therapy and they start talking about all of this and they fight it. And I say, don't fight it. Because I think what's really happening is that all these things were going on before anyway. And in order to really heal from all of it, all of this stuff has to come up. Every bit of it. And it's going to be coming up for a while for us to be able to look at it. So we can have finally that conversation. Yes. To decide who do we really want to be as Americans? Because our shadow sides, all of us, are being acted out on the political arena. Mm-hmm. You know, we can deny it, but it's there. And that's why it's becoming the way it is. Because we have people politically in power who are tapping into psyches of people. It was there.
It's all shadow work.
It's all shadow work.
It is.
Exactly. And so I kind of look at it a little differently. I don't like it. It's uncomfortable. Who does like it? But it needs to happen for our growth as a nation.
Yep.
And I do hope that we will get to the other side and we will be better for it. It will take time. It might take some destruction. But I think we will all learn about it because I have a lot of faith in Americans and the United States. And so it's an interesting time. And I think a very, very important and critical time.
And I think about the power of social media where we say we're tired of the polarized conversations. And yet this is a real opportunity for us to surface the deep, ugly work mm-hmm. that's been going on in our country. And I think what would have happened if Germany had had social media? They might not have gone down the path that they did, which led to World War II.
Mm-hmm. So. And there's a lot of good that's happening on social media as well. And Christine has kind of motivated me. We're laughing about social media because I wasn't really using it before this. But I have gotten in touch with so many groups doing such good yes. work. And I see their tweets and I see the kinds of things that they're doing. And that's out there too. And it's not about us being better than them. It's about the good things they're doing to help humanity. And that's out there. And we shouldn't lose sight of that as well.
Yeah. We're both laughing because neither one of us are hashtag people. And yet, right. When we first met over lunch, I said, you know, just listening to Dr. Boris talk about her book and her process, I said, what? And I said, I am so concerned about the hashtag Me Too movement in that it is the positive is surfacing a lot of facts mm-hmm. and a lot of reality. The downside is that no one will know what to do with it afterward, after everything is out. And I said, what you teach around forgiveness is the next step. It so is. Why don't we do a hashtag leaders forgive, at which we started 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say, if you haven't started yet, you better start right now yeah. because that is brilliant yeah. and yeah. it will have an impact.
So Dr. Boris videoed for us a little short segment kicking off every week. So that goes up on our hashtag. And then we have some questions that we've sent out to people if they want to just kind of noodle about them and get into the conversation.
Perfect.
So as much as she said she doesn't do tweets, I have to say she's been very vigilant about posting several times a day. So it's like, well, she's getting in there. She's getting in there.
I want to get that message out about the power of forgiveness. And if you can couple it with leaders forgive to help change the mindset of leaders, because we've got two types of leaders going on. We have the authoritarian type leaders, which we see all over the place, but we also have transformational leaders. And what this world needs, obviously, is the transformational leaders. But it will require that inner work that Ralph Meyer, who I just talked about, mm-hmm. went to do. And as a result of him doing that, it changed an entire country. So if leaders can begin to think about the importance of that inner work and looking at their mindsets, looking at their belief systems that they have erroneously been holding because they haven't explored, why am I doing this? You know, and you know, we look at the principles. The Athena principles are wonderful. The first one is authenticity. Well, you've got to know yourself. And if you know your North Star, if you know yourself and who you are and what you represent and the values guide you, that's a whole different kind of leadership. And it does take a lot of courage.
It takes a lot of courage and a lot of self-forgiveness as well as forgiveness outside of ourselves.
That's where it starts.
Yeah. Talk about Athena Valley of the Sun, how y'all are helping grow women's leadership. We talked a little bit about the basis of it. What else is there? Is there a certification program?
We have several containers, I'll call them. So yeah. One container is around our monthly lunches where we have a deep dive discussion on one principle each month. So we'll have a seed thought leader come who juices up the conversation, some really deep conversations at the table, good report out so we can figure out what everybody else said, because I can't stand being in a room where somebody else is laughing and I want to know what they laughed about. So we have that. Then we have a leadership certification. So that's an 8-month program. And then for me, the biggest piece of work right now is our young Athenas. So these are women who are juniors and seniors in high school. So the first year we kind of stumbled upon it when we did our Athena Awards last year, and we had the young Athenas become the MCs at the award. And people were just astounded at their sophistication and the way they handled themselves. And they were juniors, seniors in high school, freshmen, sophomores in college. This year, we specifically narrowed it down to juniors, seniors in high school so that we could start to see what were the issues that they were facing. And 10 women applied for to become a young Athena. So they went through a training, half a day on the Athena principles. They had to do a half a day of volunteer work where I watched them interact with from their volunteer role with each other and with the participants at this conference. It was Dina Patton's Girls Rule Symposium.
Dina, yes.
And then they were interviewed. And I wanted to know what they were doing in their community to make a difference. And then I was going to narrow it down to 6, and I couldn't. So I had to find a job for all 10. And then that sparked in me, okay, now we're only touching 10 young women here. So my goal next year is to get into Title I schools and have 200 young women participate in the Young Athena program between now and the next awards in 2019. So
how can we help you do that?
Let's get the word out. Let's get the word out to the high schools who want to participate. Yay. And anybody who wants to help support the Young Athena program, you know, just donate online, because we have the workbooks that we're going to give them. We're going to put them through an 8-month training program. We're going to try and link them up with some more of a group mentoring, because we don't have the person power yet to do some one-on-one matching. But boy, I'm sorry, girl, I'm coming after you. These young women are our future. They are absolutely the future of Arizona. And that's one of the things that really ignites me about being in Arizona, where we talk about how other states are moving so much further ahead. But we have an opportunity to be a lighthouse state. Yes. We have an opportunity to be the show me state, really show me that we can rise above being cowboys and so that we can make a real difference for women and how they are perceived in the workplace and in the world. So if we can make a difference here, and I think it's going to start with the young Athenas.
Can you imagine all those young Athenas with that kind of consciousness being trained to be such special leaders?
Yes,
the impact,
I can totally see it.
Because then they're going to leave the state. And so we've got another light somewhere else and somewhere else and somewhere else.
Yes.
I mean, it's just phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yes. And we will be the Sunshine State.
Oh, the
show me the women.
Okay. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So this to me feels like a great time to have you share with us about the awards on March 8th. Then.
Yep. We chose March 8th because it's International Women's Day. And last year I thought, oh, there will be so much activity in the state on International Women's Day. And there was nothing, nothing. So I put a stake in the ground and said, we're going to declare.
I'm claiming it.
I'm claiming it. So this will be our second awards. And we have already chosen our six recipients and for the principals. And then we have Dr. Boris representing the Athena Leadership Award, which is this amazing sculpture, bronze sculpture, numbered, for heaven's sakes. Wow. So she's going to be really excited to have that one on her desk. And so the intent is to really celebrate the women who are igniting change in Arizona. So all of the recipients were nominated by colleagues. They had to tell a story about the recipient. They had to tell their own story. We interviewed them. It was Perfect. A really extensive process. So I think people will be very delighted to see who are the recipients. And as we're speaking, we're starting to roll out their names and get... So we put their names out before the awards because we want... It's a celebration.
Are you at liberty to share who they are today or we just need to...
No, I can share.
Yeah. Yes, when you're ready, while we're preparing to share those names, if you're willing to do that, absolutely. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the books that you've written around forgiveness, because I don't want to leave this opportunity to sit as your audience and not hear a little bit about that.
Well, I've actually got two books out.
Oh, yes.
One in there.
Literally
is,
out here on our desk, on our
Finding
table.
Forgiveness.
Thank you, Vanna.
A 7-step program of letting go anger and bitterness. Oh. And it takes you through, and there's a forward by His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
I see that on the cover. That.
And you can see how I'm like marking it up a lot.
It takes you through a 7-step process on how to forgive. And so you learn about what the steps are. There's exercises in here, journal exercises, visualization exercises. And then for each step, there's a story. One chapter will be a story for one step of how people grappled with that step. Because even though I speak about this in a linear fashion, it's really not. And so I wanted people to see, we all grapple with it. That's part of what it is if you're going to do the deep work.
Yep.
There's even a story in here about His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And how he was dealing with his own anger about a situation that happened when some monks got murdered. So people really get it, that this is not necessarily easy, but it's so transformative. And the reason I wrote the book was because I was working with individuals who had incredible stories of forgiveness and how it transformed them and their lives. And the one story that really inspired me is actually in this book about Irene Lohr. Because of my interest in seeing a better world, also on a global perspective, I care very much about seeing all this genocide stop. I come from a family whose history was dealing with Nazi Germany. I'm married to a Tibetan who's also dealing with all of this. And so I began to think, how can we heal nations? So genocides don't happen anymore. So mass murder doesn't happen anymore. And of course, you know, I think about the work I've done in Rwanda in helping them. And so I developed what I'm calling political forgiveness. There are people who have talked about it, but they've never really put it in a concrete form of what is this? What does this really look like? How do we do this? Mm-hmm. So I'm developing a model of how we do this. And it, as I mentioned earlier, involves individual work. And I do that work with something called the Schools of Forgiveness, which helps people heal from domestic and political violence. And it began in Bogota, Colombia, with a friend of mine who has his foundation for reconciliation. We know there was a lot of conflict there, and a lot of people were suffering because of what took place. So work on the individual level is extremely important. But then we have to bring communities together. And there are places in this world where I think of Sierra Leone, they have this process called Fumble Talk, how they come together through bonfires and storytelling because that's indigenous to their culture, and how they've worked through a process of bringing in perpetrators who have done horrific things and through their process are able to forgive them. And then they have other things that happen along the way of teaching people skills and how to reconcile and how to resolve conflict. So there's a whole conflict resolution piece there as well as the emotional work. And then, of course, we have to work on the structural level because there's so much structural violence in this country as well as other places. And so people have got to come together and decide, how are we going to change these structures that have supported things like racism, that have supported poverty and populations? And I can go on and on with that. So that's the political forgiveness piece. And in my book on political forgiveness, which is called Takes Two to Tango, and I use the metaphor of the Argentinian tango in how we resolve conflict and how we get to do this. I talk about different countries, of course, South Africa, Colombia, and I point out what they were doing in terms of political forgiveness and where they can go from here. And there are a lot of stories like Ralph Meyer's stories in it. So people really begin to get an understanding that we can all be part of this process and we all need to be part of this process and that it works on three different levels.
So I want to frame a question for you, because when I started to look at your work on forgiveness, I was thinking, oh, it's about forgiving somebody else. And yet your first chapter is about forgiving yourself. Can you talk more about that?
We carry so much within ourselves. And just as we were saying earlier in this conversation, you know, I could see you and you could be from a different ethnic place, different whatever, and I start not liking you. That's because of stuff inside of me, which needs to be healed. And if we don't look at that, we pile more and more guilt on ourselves. When in fact, what we need to do is be gentle with ourselves and ask ourselves, why are we beating ourselves up? And we need to look at that guilt so we don't start dumping it on someone else. When you see people fighting all the time, that's really what's going on. And so we have to begin with ourselves. And there's so much we carry and we don't want to get in touch with that guilt. It doesn't feel good.
What about the anger?
Anger is a messenger. And it tells us that something has to change. If I get angry with you or with you, and you've done something that would anger anyone, I could say, hey, cut it out or whatever, you know, but an hour later, I'm totally fine. I said what I needed to say and it's gone. But if I hold on to it, that's an indication that there's something inside of me that needs to be healed. For example, there was a client I was working with back in New York, and he came in to see me and he started telling me about this horrific scene in the subway of how somebody pushed this woman, this pregnant woman, into the subway tracks as a subway was coming. Well, we'd all be really upset about it and we'd all go home and we'd all talk about it. But then the next day we'd go on with our lives. He couldn't let go of it. And so exploring it, I said to him, what are you accusing that man of? Because you're secretly accusing yourself of it. And he was able to say, well, here he's enticed this woman to come. And then he pushes her away. And I said, well, clearly you haven't ever done this in the subway, but somewhere else in your life? And he stopped and he started to cry. And he said, you know, for extra money, I am a clown. And I go dressed up as a clown to kids' parties, to hospitals. And, you know, I don't really like kids. So here I am. I entice them to come. And I pushed them away.
And he could own it.
And then he could forgive himself.
And forgive this horrific act that he witnessed.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Great question. And such a critical component of who we are and how we grow and evolve as a human being in this, you know, this soulful experience that we call humanity. Wow.
Yeah.
I have so much to share with you after we're off air, because I have just a lot of wonderful thoughts flying through my mind and my heart as we connect. And I know that our listeners are feeling the same way. Would you be willing to take us back to the Athena Awards and share who these glorious...
It seems like a strange transition. Yeah. Yes, transition.
Do you want to linger?
I do. Yeah. I do, because I think there is so much that we can learn from hearing people's... Well, actually, it does transition in some way, in that when we hear people's stories of how they over... were overcoming things that were obstacles in their life. That's what these recipients are being acknowledged for. So being acknowledged for the courage to get through breast cancer and to start an organization called Don't Be a Chump, Look for
Holly
a Lump.
Holly Rose.
Yes, she's one of our recipients.
Of course, yep. I'm happy to hear that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Deborah Kuntz, who has done her life's work around servant leadership.
Oh, wow.
And that to me is, you know, that's courageous work there. We have Maya Bernadette, whose life has been around repairing tribal relationships in Arizona. Sandra Schrock, who is, I call her, coming from a heart, and now she has a business in technology. So she's had to put herself on a learning curve about what is technology. Mm-hmm. And so hers is learn constantly. It's like, okay, that's a good example. Jill Mapstead, who is the current president of the board for the YWCA, just when you hear her story of how she has dealt with having a healthy child and a not healthy child, and how she is that has shaped her advocacy positions, is just absolutely perfect for Advocate Fiercely. And then Deborah Welsh is our Live Authentically. Oh, I forgot. Sorry. Susan Quartz is the Foster Collaboration. And then Deborah Welsh is the Servant Leadership around Live Authentically. So those are our recipients.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yep.
And at the awards celebration, we'll get to hear from each of them and just get to bask in their wisdom and wow, as well as honoring them.
Yeah. We have a great process for introducing them. And then the role of the Young Athenas is to interview them on stage. So they get to be really upfront and blurt out whatever they're thinking, which is so much better than a speech.
Absolutely. Is this event invitation only, or can people still
register? It's totally open up to the public, and just go to athenaaz.com for registration. So we're open and ready to receive registrations.
Yeah. Fantastic. Oh my goodness.
Yep.
What else? What else would you like to share? I know there's two more beautiful books sitting here that you must tell me about.
Well, actually, I'm going to start backwards. So when this one is about becoming Athena, which is written by Martha Mertz. And so when I first met her, I kept thinking of the Athena work as being just an awards piece. And so over lunch, she opens up the book and she says, Here are the principles right here, this page, 96 and 97. And I just took one glance at them and I went, okay, if I had had these back in the 70s and 80s, I would have been really different. Mm-hmm. So where have these been? And so she tells me the story of how they were, you know, the Center for Creative Leadership did the research. And then she said, sitting in the room helping us synthesize the work was Margaret Wheatley, who is my other guru person who wrote this book, Finding Our Way, Leadership in Uncertain Times. And so I thought, okay, there's credibility here. If we go from Meg Wheatley, Martha Mertz, and then others, I thought. And then this year, coming across Dr. Boris, and it's like now all of a sudden I have my trilogy of books.
Absolutely.
My trilogy of books, How to Be, Finding Our Way, Becoming Athena, and Finding Forgiveness.
Fantastic.
So that's how I would say, go out and get these books right now.
So I love that that you've shared that, and we'll make sure that we have them with a summary when we have this as a podcast for replay. And the books have gotten reordered, landing with your book on top around forgiveness, which leads me to another question. After hearing you speak, how can people get more involved in schools of forgiveness? Like,
that's a great question. I'm on the board of Forgiveness International, and one of the things I want to be starting here in Arizona, and maybe this is going to be how we're going to really work together, is I want to train people, have people go through the Schools of Forgiveness workshops. And it's for people who want to learn how to forgive, people who have issues that they want to work through in forgiveness, and people who are just really wanting to learn this so they can go back into their own organizations, into their schools, to the tribal regions. And so there's a whole program that I can give on the Schools of Forgiveness, and there's a certification process. So if we can start getting enough people who are interested, and we need to get some funding to start this, then we can start the schools, and then it begins to have a multiplier effect, because once people are certified, they can take the materials and they can begin to replicate this work. And that's really exciting. And then we want to have some way of linking people, like a listserv or something. So if Christine takes the training and then she's working in her classroom and something comes up, she's got a whole cadre of people that she can say, gee, I had this incident happen. Can you help me?
Yep.
And this is work that has been already done in Colombia, and it has now spread to every single country in South America. There's doing some now in Central America and Mexico. And now we're trying to really start solidifying this work here. There's a group in Boston doing it, people in Portland. I want Arizona to be a hub. And this is how we're going to be able to build what I call the culture of forgiveness.
So again, my question is, how can we help you? Who do you need to be in front of? I mean, obviously you're in great company here with Athena Valley of the Sun, but how can Phoenix Business Radio X support you as well, and our listeners?
I need to get in front of people who feel so strongly about this that, first of all, they'll fund this kind of project, and then people who really want to participate in this, leaders, so they can go back into their organization, teachers, so they can use this in school. So we really need money to start this project so we can begin to give these trainings. And then the people who really want to participate. And the reason why the funding piece is so important is because I want to be able to get people who are in South Phoenix. I want to get people who are the Latinas here who are struggling, who have things that they really want to deal with. So I want to be able to provide some of this where people can come no matter what their financial situation is.
Yep. Can you share about your grant application for Afghanistan?
Oh, okay. Hopefully.
Oh, that.
She forgets these other accomplishments.
Hopefully I'll be going to Afghanistan in the near future. We're working on a project where this is through the Thunderbird for Good office at Thunderbird School of Global Management, where I teach, and through USAID, U.S. Agency of International Development, where I'm the academic director and developing a project to work with women, to empower women to be able to come together, because here they've been so isolated. And, you know, they don't even really have a name. They're the daughter of, or the, you know, the wife of. And start bringing them together to give them some skills so they can go out and start their own businesses or work with cottage industries. Mm-hmm. But also, I'm there to change the norms of the country, to begin to empower also men to say, it's okay. It's important that we let our women go out and work for all the reasons we talked about earlier on this show. And I'm developing things like PSA and type announcements where you see men talking to other people saying, I'm so proud of my wife who's able to do this because it's helped our family so much.
Modeling it. Yeah.
And you know, developing probably some card games and all other kinds of things to help influence the society to change their norms, to allow women to be who they truly need to be. So that's a little taste of the Afghan project.
Do either of you sleep?
No.
Yeah, what is sleep?
I do get 8 hours, but the brain is active the entire time.
Yeah. Wow.
I know that we could talk forever. I have many more questions, and I know you have many more stories and anecdotes to share. I would like to invite you both back again and again and again and again.
We're a pretty good pair,
you
I think.
You are a dynamic duo, and with the trilogy of books that you've mentioned and just the great work that you're doing. I know you mentioned Dina Patton and the great work with Girls Rule Foundation. That's what I keep hearing as we're having this conversation is I have an opportunity through Business Radio X to really every day sit in front of magnificent, phenomenal men and women who are doing great work in our state of Arizona. And you've mentioned collaboration and connecting and I'm really pleased that you've mentioned some of the people I already am aware of. I mean, the great work Holly Rose is doing with Don't Be a Chump, Check for a Lump. She's been on our show before. So whatever help I can be of with you in bringing, again, these incredible leaders so that we can all embrace this idea around personal forgiveness, community forgiveness, international and nationwide forgiveness. And I'm probably, you know, botching up the way that you would label that, but that's through my my small little vantage point, how I see the great work that you're doing, and not necessarily in those layers, but it has to be all collectively happening at the same time, does it not?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Karen, I want to say thank you for convening us. You've just been an incredible igniter for us. And the spark today has given me the courage to continue onward. So I thank you for that.
And whatever I can do to help continue to support that and have us continue to tell these great stories, because you both are great storytellers. And it's, and we, you know, we talked a little bit about social media, and my piece of what I love about so much about social media and video is that we get to see and feel and hear and experience those stories so that we are motivated to change and inspired to change. So however, again, we can be of service to you to do that. I would love to continue to stay in connection.
And thank you so much for initiating this conversation and the great thought you've put into this and the questions, and just it adds so much richness to all of this. So thank you very much.
You are very welcome. I'm very honored, and we do look forward to having you both back. You've been listening to Phoenix Business Radio with Business Radio X. Some media leans left, some lean right, and we lean business. Until next time, I'm Kara Nowicki.